Right, well, welcome to Spotlight once again, introduced by me, Steve, in the centre of England here. And first of all, as always, I'd like to thank Becky for her work on Spotlight, arranging things, and on this occasion to Dennis for actually recording the programme for us for later transmission. Today, I've got the very great pleasure of introducing someone who's very well known on For the People. Leon from England, about 120 miles from me. And first of all, Leon, as always, I'd just like to thank you for agreeing to be interviewed and start by asking you, where and when were you born?
Okay, thanks there, Steve, and good afternoon or evening to everyone. Yes, I kind of did agree to do the Spotlight some time ago now, and then I thought, well, it's, you know, the pressure was on a little bit just recently, and I thought, but thanks for your reassuring nature, Steve. I've been okay about doing it, and I thought, well, it'd be great to just get it out of the way. I'm just outside of London in a place called Witton, and the nearest large town is Twickenham, famous for the international rugby ground. And it's just outside of West London in the Thames Valley area. The actual county is Middlesex. And I am a Londoner. I was born in West London, in Chiswick, in a house and not a hospital. And I have got two sisters. And I've spent most of my life growing up in West London and around the West London area, West London and Middlesex, which is the first county you come into coming out of London. So, I was born in 65. So it gives you some idea of my age there, if you can work that out quickly enough. I feel a bit young, Steve, to be doing a Spotlight interview, to be honest, you know. I said to you about that, it feels a bit like on This Is Your Life when they interview someone who's not very old. And I apologise if I haven't got too much of a tale to tell, but there we go. Anyway, so I was born in Chiswick, and I come from a family where I've got two sisters, one who's 2 years older and one who's 2 years younger, so I was like the boy in the middle. My parents split up when I was very young, and basically when me and my sisters were 4, 6 and 8, so that is an early on age. And since then, my father has remarried to a woman who had 3 children from her first marriage. So I've basically, there are, if you don't count steps and half brothers and things like that, I'm actually the second oldest of a family of 7 now, and that's how it's worked out. And I've got 4 parents. I've got a mum and a stepdad who live in Brentford, and a dad and a stepmum who live in Twickenham. So quite unusual situation, really, but it is one case where a divorce within the family kind of worked out for the better in the end, and we've got one big family now, and we all get along pretty well. So hopefully that answers your question there.
Absolutely, a great roundabout Christmas at your house, I should think, and birthdays. It must be a real treat, I should think, with all those extra presents and stuff. So what sort of a childhood did you have in your early days? What sort of things did you used to get up to when you were growing up?
Oh, well, I got up to quite a lot. You know, I was actually very bright. One thing I'm very grateful for is that my mum encouraged me to read a lot when I was younger. And it did mean when I got to go to junior school and things like that, I had a very high reading age for my age. You know, I had a reading age of about 15 when I was about 8, I believe. It was something like that anyway. And whether it was reading Enid Blyton books or James Hadley Chase thrillers or whatever it was, or doing the Puzzler magazine. She used to get me and my sisters doing puzzles and things like that. And anyway, I was much encouraged to read, so I was always a keen reader when I was growing up. And as regards hobbies, a few things. I did a little bit of fishing. I used to collect matchbox tops from the different boxes of matches from all around the country and all around the world, and I had a complete set of Swan Vesta matchboxes going back to the old 6D, the old money days, right up to the modernist one. I also enjoyed cycling a lot when I was younger. I used to pedal all around the place, and I was keen at customising my own bike. And then as I got older, things kind of developed like they naturally do, and I got into a bit of radio control model engineering and that kind of stuff. I've done quite a diverse range of things when I was young, and I had some very great times too. The things that particularly stand out, I think, from one's childhood, you tend to remember the best and the worst, and I had some particularly good holidays. I do remember always looking forward to the annual holiday when sometimes we'd be piling into the back of a Morris Minor van and off down to Wales or off to Brackleshan Bay on the east coast, and I really did look forward to holidays. That was about the most exciting, you know, if I look back at my childhood, what was the happiest times, I think it really was those times that stood out. But I thoroughly enjoyed school, and I didn't become miscreant at all at school until I reached the dreaded teenage years, and that happens to a lot of people, so I'll probably spare you some of the details on that one. But yeah, I had a happy childhood, basically. I certainly wouldn't complain about it. I know I've got a lot of friends who went through a lot worse time than I did, and I'm very grateful that things kind of worked out okay in that respect.
Yeah, okay, I'm interested in your early academic potential. You know, obviously you had a very advanced reading age. Did you get bored at school? You know, were you one of these poor kids who were very, very clever and used to sit there at the back of the or at the front of the class thinking, oh, it's boring in here? Did they recognize your potential and encourage you, or did you have to, you know, grin and bear it?
Now, that is a good question. This is exactly what I was like. Very clever, but wouldn't pay attention at all. And in actual fact, once upon a time, it was only about 5 years or so ago now, my mum surprised both me and both of my sisters by digging out our old school reports and sending them to us. So I've actually got all my old school reports here, going right back to junior school. And I used to write I was writing poetry for the school magazine and things like this. And but most of the reports did say that I had really great potential if only I could concentrate. So, you know, I've tended to be, I don't know, fairly quick thinking when I was young, you know, and, you know, I took a lot of stuff for granted. And yes, that basically was the problem. I had great potential. I ended up going to a large school, Chiswick Comprehensive School, which was one of these ones. There were approximately 300 children in each year of age. So it's one of these schools where you don't tend to get noticed unless you do anything different. You know, you just disappear in the crowd and the teachers forget your name and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, it was a very mainstream school. Excuse the train going past there, I live right near to a railway. Yeah, that was the case, Steve. I got bored at school, and as a result, there was lots of playing cards at lunchtime with friends and, you know, doing anything that you would do at that kind of age, you know, to kind of satisfy that boredom. So, yeah, I didn't tend to get... Well, I got recognised. I think they actually hit the nail right on the head, you know. It was that the potential was there, but, you know, the focus wasn't, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can understand that, you know, that could actually happen. We haven't actually pointed out something very interesting about you and for the people, and that is you are a sighted person. I think it's pretty fair to say that probably about, or hazard a guess, 99% of us are blind or partially sighted, but you are fully sighted, so hence the reference to your school of 300. You didn't go to boarding school or anything because you're a sighted guy, and you went to an ordinary run-of-the-mill school in London. So I just point that out to the people who may not know that you are, in fact, a fully sighted member of the Peeps.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And one of the things that's happened to me a couple of times in my history on For the People, firstly, when I sign in together with my partner on here, we sign in together as Jay and Leon. And first of all, a few people thought that I was Jay's guide dog when they see the two name, because you get the two name combination. So just to avoid confusion there, I've got two legs, not four. But yes, I am fully sighted. I've got 20/20 vision, and I'm a legal driver in the UK. I drive all the time, and I don't know whether I ought to, perhaps go into, the subject of what some of my experience of working with visually impaired people has been at this stage. But yes, I'm very grateful that I have got good sight, and more or less, I wouldn't say entirely, because it's quite a broad sense of the term, I'm without disabilities as well. You know, I'm quite physically fit.
Yeah, that's fine. And we're, you know, really, really pleased to have you you know, along with us. You're a great asset to the site. So, okay, you're at school and you stayed at school. Did you move on to a second school, or did you attend the same school from early childhood until the time you left? And supplementary question, had you got any career plans when you were actually at school?
Well, in actual fact, I was really, really interested in everything electronic when I was younger. This was another of my hobbies, and when I was a certain age, probably around about 12, something like that, somebody gave me, well, my parents, for one Christmas, a Grundig radio, which you could tune all around the world, had all the shortwave bands and all this stuff, so I was really into listening to the radio and playing around and, you know, going to jumble sales, things like that, and collecting old anything electronic junk and trying to fix it, and, you know, even had a soldering iron and used to play around with electronic things. And when I left school, at the age of 16, I went into an apprenticeship. Now, it doesn't happen so much these days, but at the time, there were a lot of apprenticeships going, and what that meant was you could go out and do a job where you were working on the job, and they gave you a day's leave from the job to go to college for the theory part of the study, and then during the practical part of your work, you would be working. And I was working as a trainee electronic engineer at one time, and I basically did 1 year of broad-based training when I was age 17 that included a little bit of everything to do with engineering, not just specialist in electronics. So I got to do a bit of lathe turning. I've still got a toolbox here, which I made myself out of sheet metal, and, you know, arc welded up the edges and did all that stuff to do with metalwork and fabrication. I did a little bit of work on pneumatics, and so I went off to do engineering, and it really did appeal to me because I'd had this thing, you know, since childhood, anything that was in the least bit clever or needed understanding or assembling or putting together, I was really interested in. So I kind of met those aspirations a little bit when I left school to do my apprenticeship.
So what actually happened, Leon? Something obviously stopped you being the electronics engineer.
Yes, it did. Basically, the period of the apprenticeship was 3 years, and I was 2 years into my apprenticeship, and Maggie Thatcher was in power at the time, and I'm sure you remember, Steve, the recession during the early 80s, and it was very unfortunate that basically I was made redundant. The company I was working for lost the contract. They supplied generators to Middle East and Far East countries, which involved, you know, bringing in large diesel engines, fitting them together with alternators, running them up, tuning them, and putting the circuitry on, and then shipping them out. And they lost the contract, and as a result, all the apprentices got made redundant. So I was 2 years into apprenticeship, so I was neither young enough to start a whole new apprenticeship, neither was I fully qualified to use, you know, the full apprenticeship to allow me to get a decent job. So it was then very, very difficult to continue working in engineering, much as I wanted to. There was very, very little work going in that field for someone of that age, and it was very difficult being halfway through. So the result of that was that I ended up completely changing my career direction, and I've pretty much, excuse the minor bird there, zigzagged over about the last 20 years, you know, ever since. I've been going in all sorts of different directions for work. I've enjoyed the diversity of that very, very much.
Yeah, I think you told me at some stage that you've actually worked for a film design company, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I did, yeah. Yeah. In fact, that was my my very second job, Steve. A job came up for basically a props assistant at a company called Set Pieces, who were, I found out it was over in East Acton in West London. I went over there to go for the interview, and I ended up working there for a few years. And basically, it was a company which hired out props to the whole television industry. There's a whole trading estate there over in East Acton where that's what all the companies do. Supply sets and do set design, and you know, I was put in charge of balustrades and all this kind of stuff, and we used to have a large number of you know, it's like a huge furniture warehouse where buyers from the film companies, because obviously they don't buy this stuff to use it one off for a film, they hire it out at a percentage of risk value, and buyers and set designers used to come round and say, I'll take this, I'll take that, and as a result, to this day I can still be watching television, and I might be, for example, watching Wogan on television and say, oh, I recognise that coffee table, and I recognise that sofa suite and things like that. And so it was quite nice to see the sets, and all the backdrops and different things. So yeah, it was basically a service industry to the film industry, and I thoroughly enjoyed that, and got to meet a lot of people through the work, and also to get a good sense of sort of interior design related stuff, which I'm still very, very into.
Yeah, so basically you were using your artistic skills rather than your electronic knowledge. Would that be fair to say? You were sort of constructing sets for various things. Have I got that right?
That's right, yeah, and I got to find a few muscles I didn't know I had before as well, because, vans would turn up urgently from cine trucks, and the different film supply companies, desperately needed something for one of the sets, so there was a very strict boss there, and, when the pressure was on, he used to crack the whip even more, and so it was very hard work for very little pay, even though you enjoyed it. It was very hard work physically as well. There was a lot of carrying and carting and shifting and packing, and you didn't get a spare minute from when you got there at 8:30 in the morning till a good 6 o'clock in the evening, and around the time I think I was working for about £60 a week, which wasn't very much at all. So it was good for the creative side, but also for manual labour. I hadn't had any work that was as hard work as that before. I used to come home very tired every night.
Yeah, I can imagine, after humping scenery around all day. So what happened to Leon's career after that then? I know there's a lot to your story, so we've got to move it on a little bit. You've packed a lot into your life, even though you told us at the start you haven't got much to say, but you have indeed. So what actually happened after that?
Well, as I say, I pretty much went through lots of different jobs, Steve. One of the more interesting ones along the way was that there was a new arts centre opened up in Brentford on the River Thames, and Brentford's where I'm originally from, or I lived there for 16 years anyway, and it's like immediately outside of West London on the River Thames. And a new art centre called the Waterman's Art Centre opened there, and it's still open, and I got a job working there as a publicity assistant, and that's where I first started to get some of my computer experience. They had a Wang computer, and they used Ataris for the desktop publishing, and I used to be responsible for making sure press listings of all the events that went on. Basically there was a theatre, cinema, art gallery, everything all in one venue right on the riverside, taking care of all the publicity and making sure that the events that were on got listed in the local papers, and that publicity and posters and printing and all that stuff was taken care of. So it pretty much got me into computer graphics, and it was a very interesting job. I used to get complimentary tickets or comps for all the different events that were on, which meant I could get into the cinema and the theatre free whenever I wanted to as a result of working at the venue. So that was one of the more interesting jobs. And one of the ones that went onto that, and this now we're coming to about 1989 to 90, I got a job working for a company which was a multi-faxing bureau. It was around the time of the fax boom, around the early 90s, fax had really caught on as an industry, and I was working then for an international company which basically distributed a vast amount of faxes using automatic dialing machines. They also had automatic line telex, and it was a job with on-the-job training. So I basically ended up working very early on as a computer communications operator. So that's where I really got my first experience of dealing with and having a lot to do with international communications. So that was a real boost. That's the one that really sealed me in the IT direction, if you like.
Okay, Leon, so that's your interest in computers kicked off. I was surprised you weren't actually into computers before that, with your interest in electronics, And I do believe as well that you've actually been instrumental in designing websites as well. I do know that you've done that. Can you tell us a little bit about that and which actual website you did the design for?
Yeah, sure thing there, Steve. Yeah, I did actually, I got into web design, basic HTML, really early on. People nowadays, just occasionally I'm speaking to them and they say, well, you know, I'm thinking about doing my first web page. I actually did my first web pages for one of the organisations I work for, St James's House in Camden, in around about 1995, which is like 7 years ago now. And basically, you know, when the internet had first become available at local call rates and all this stuff, I was working there as an office skills trainer, and I decided that, you know, we were going to have an internet connection on one of the machines, and so I basically set up a website. I bought one of the first digital cameras that had ever come out and took lots of pictures of the various parts of this project I was working for, and so we put a web page online in 95, and to great acclaim. It was actually really quite well recognised, for a site which basically communicated all the information about an organisation and, provided a source of information. But one of the problems was, and of course, that there was a minority of people who are on the internet. It's not sort of, it's 50% of UK households at the moment, I believe. But at the time, there were very few people with net access. So I got involved in it then, and I've played around with various web page editing software, and I'm really into computer graphics, electronic imaging, image editing, page layout and all that kind of stuff, so it kind of all merged, although a lot of the stuff I've done has been self-taught, you know. I did actually end up going at one point in 93, I believe it was, to Manchester Metropolitan University, part-time, where I did a certificate in advanced internet skills at the end of it. I did the basic one first, and then I went on to do the advanced one. Now, it's changed a lot now, Steve, but a lot of the stuff that I learned is still relevant by today's standards. You know, they are still using HTML for web pages, thank God. So, it's something that I've been doing for quite some time now, although I kind of got a little bit over the hill more recently. In recent times, I ended up getting involved in some very interesting website work, including for a national cancer charity in the UK. I got involved there providing their technical support, setting up their computer network, you know, on the premises, and maintaining, keeping that running, including keeping it virus-free and all this kind of stuff, and also running the website which was run for the nationwide Loud Tie Day campaign, which I don't know if you ever heard about. So that was probably the highest profile of the web work that I've done, was the National Cancer Charity website and support.
Yeah, can you tell us just a little bit about the cancer charity website? What sort of information can people get from that? And is it a specific type of cancer it actually deals with, or is it a general? Is it a more generic one, or is it specific?
Well, yes, it is specific. It specifically relates to, because the name of the organisation gives it all away straight away, it's Beating Bowel Cancer is the name of the organisation, and basically, through working with, and I think I've told you about this, Steve, I got to meet Lynn Fordswood, who's a lady over here in the UK that used to present BBC Watchdog, who basically had, she was a bowel cancer survivor. She had found out when she had a 3-year-old son and hadn't been married for too long, that, you know, the doctor had been giving her sort of stories that weren't quite accurate about her health condition, and when she went to see a specialist, it turned out she'd had bowel cancer in the last stages and basically was in a whisker away from losing her life. She normally almost lost her life to it, and thankfully was saved, and then went on to form this charity, which originally was called the Crocus Trust, and set it up. Basically, it was providing information because the situation at the time of the UK, according to National Health Statistics, was that approximately 1/3 of all the people across the country that contracted bowel cancer would die from it. You know, it's a particularly nasty type. The Americans refer to it generally as colon cancer, which unless it's caught in the early stages, can be absolutely fatal. And what effect this had upon me was that, while I was over there working in that environment, typically the telephone could ring any time, and it could be somebody from the press related to one of the press and publicity fundraising campaigns, and you may get calls from TV companies, you know, on publicity issues. And on the other hand, that very same phone call, as you picked it up, could have been someone who had spotted early symptoms and, you know, was seeking advice and was in quite serious distress about potentially having a fatal disease. So, it was a very unusual environment to work in, and one in which required a lot of diplomacy. But yeah, basically, the charity since I've left them have now gone on and paid a consultancy firm to do the website, but you could check it out, although it's not my work anymore, at www.beatingbowelcancer.org. That's the address on that one. But at the time that I was doing it, in the Loud Thai campaign for 2000, as a result of the work that I was doing there, I got to go to the London Weekend Television Studios in central London, where there was a presentation by Prince Charles himself, which is rather good. And basically I've still got a lot of the photographs and information here, which I'd be only happy to share with somebody or talk further on that same subject if anyone would like to any time.
Oh, that's excellent, Leon. Did you meet Prince Charles on that occasion? And if so, what did he say? What did you say?
Well, I didn't get to speak to him personally, no, because the whole entourage arrived at the LWT building. And when I say entourage, it's major for one of the royals to travel anywhere. You know, there is a lot of security. And also, it was a high publicity profile event. And like Desmond Lynham was there, for example, and so quite a few TV personalities from over here. So I basically didn't have much chance of, barging through. You certainly wouldn't do it or anything. But what Prince Charles did do, which was great, was to give his support to the charity and to the cause and say that, people ought to think more seriously, because the situation is that people were basically too embarrassed to even talk about conditions and health conditions related to their bowels and their digestive system. And as a result, they were keeping quiet, about potential symptoms, which could mean they could have a fatal disease. So he made a really positive speech about overcoming that stigma and saying, look, we cannot have a common cancer going around in the UK, which was at the time the number two killer behind breast cancer, I believe it was, where, roughly a third of people that contract it are dying because they're not getting the required help. So he added his weight to the conversation, but I got within yards of him, Steve. That was as close as it got.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. Now, if I can just jump ahead just a little bit more, because I think to most of us and for the people, you are very well known for your ability to help blind people with our access technology. I became aware of that very quickly when I first started to speak to you on for the people. I suddenly realized that, hey, this sighted guy is really knowledgeable about our screen readers and the way we do things. What was your introduction to working with blind people? Had you ever met any blind people, or had you got any blind friends? I'm just curious as to how you got involved.
Right, okay, yeah. Fair question as well. Right, if I go back to my first ever experience with anyone who was blind or visually impaired, it had to be with my piano teacher. As a child, I had a blind piano teacher, and he didn't miss a trick. If I played a note wrong, he had one of these rolling boards that you could turn around. He turned it around on the back, and it had braille representations of the notes on the front. And there's absolutely no way, if I played an E and he said it should have been an E flat, it should have been an E flat. And I was sent off to piano lessons, another thing I'm grateful to my parents for. And that was my first ever experience of anyone that was blind at all. And then there were sort of one or two, people with visual disabilities tend to be a minority in the community, and you don't meet too many in any one setting. But then, not long after I'd graduated from Brunel, which is kind of a bit of a time jump, because I went on to train as a teacher, basically. I did a City and Guilds 730, which is a further an adult education teacher certificate, based on a community project that I was working at, teaching desktop publishing. And I decided I really wanted to be a fully-fledged teacher, so I went off to Brunel University and did my Sir Ed. Now, I've just completed my teacher training, and the most important thing when you've completed teacher training is to get some experience straight away. So what I ended up doing was approaching Richmond Adult and Community College, which was basically the nearest college in my community, and saying, well, look, I've decided I want to become a teacher and I want to do special needs. And what they did was they offered a course there, which was basically called a special needs development course. You develop your special needs teaching skills on it. And they gave me a practical placement as a classroom assistant in one of the classes they had going on there. which was basically for adults with visual impairments. They were offering just computer courses at the time, and so I started to work as a voluntary classroom assistant so that I would get the practical hours I needed to qualify. And that's the first situation really where I saw a whole bunch of blind people in one setting, and it was a learning setting where I kind of saw them on group, and I very much enjoyed that. I really did like working as assistant. I really got on well with the people that I met, and that's where I first got to see the dreaded HAL, British screen reader, that is, for those that don't know, working in operation, and looking at screen magnifiers and the various access technology. So basically through working as a classroom assistant while I was still doing my training is how I first got to approach the whole thing. And then it went a little bit further, as I've told you before, Steve.
Yeah, so these blind people that were coming into Richmond College then, were they just people from the local area who wanted to learn a little bit about computers, or what was the catchment area?
Well, this is the funny thing. The catchment area of Richmond Adult College is actually aimed at the London Borough of Richmond upon Thames, which is a very affluent area. But the funny thing was that there's two surrounding boroughs, Hounslow and Kingston, which are considerably poorer by comparison, and probably more than half of the students came from other boroughs where there were no local facilities. Basically, the most that most areas had would be like a local blind club, which would be typically for older blind people and wasn't very active at all, and the colleges in their boroughs still to this day do not have any provision for visually impaired students. So Richmond Adults, a mainstream college with a small amount of provision for visually impaired students, and that appealed to them simply because there was nowhere else to go. If they wanted to learn Braille, they had to come across to that borough. So basically the whole catchment area roughly was from the three surrounding boroughs, and it still is, so we could have anyone from the London Borough of Hounslow or the London Borough of Kingston as well coming across. Not many miles for them to travel, and a lot of them would have arranged transport, etc. So that was the area covered, basically. As I say, the courses, the reason people were travelling across from their borough is because there just simply wasn't anything for them in their area. You know, they'd have had to travel considerably further in any other direction to find any facilities that were accessible at all.
Okay, that's understood. And what sort of thing were you teaching the people on their course? I'm just guessing that it was probably basic introduction to computers and screen readers, because I think it's pretty fair to say that most blind people haven't experienced screen readers or computers, certainly not in England. Maybe it's different in America, but certainly not over here. So what sort of thing were you teaching them?
You're quite right there, Steve. Starting with basically computer basics, and introducing the screen reader software and getting them into basic word processing. And once someone had done basic word processing, they'd be fairly fluent, with the main commands of the screen reader, and then they could consider going on to more advanced subjects. You could either take word processing further or diversify into different office skills. And at that time, that was as far as it went. There really weren't any advanced courses. So if you did have someone, and I quite agree with you that most blind people in the UK do not have any experience with technology at all. It is a shame, but it's true, sadly. Most of the students kind of were okay about doing these things, like beginners courses and whatever, but there weren't really any advanced courses on offer. So if anyone was a bright spark amongst the various visually impaired students, and there were quite a few of them around, they soon got bored, because you would want to, once you knew your word processing, you would be looking to move on to something else, and there wasn't really anything else available other than training in Microsoft Office to sort of level one at the time.
And as you indicated a few minutes back, you were using HAL as a screen reader, which isn't the best screen reader in the world. A personal opinion, but I think most blind people would probably agree. So how did you get to grips with how we do things? It's all very well having it nicely presented on the screen to you, but again, I'm generalizing, I know, but most sighted people seem to think that they'll never be able to understand a speech synthesizer, no matter which screen reader it is. Did you actually master listening to synthetic speech?
Well, I wouldn't quite say mastered. I'm certainly I'm not as fluent as somebody like Dennis, who's there. You know, I mean, I've heard some very fluent screen reader users, and the speed that they run their speech at all the time is beyond me. I can't hear all that well, and I just hear blah 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 go past, and they've heard an entire sentence. You know, but what I made a point of doing was to get some Access software onto my home machine and to test it and play around with it. One thing was, I was extremely frustrated by how the British screen reader, the navigation was okay on it was good for office stuff, but you couldn't take it any further. The moment there was anything advanced to be done, it would have problems reading and all this kind of stuff. So I was determined, A, that I was going to work out ways in which, because we were stuck with HAL at the college, that we could get access to more advanced applications, because I thought it was very important that people would be able to move on. You know, people were being left high and dry, basically, after doing their basic training. They were just left to it. And I wanted people to be able to get to more advanced applications and things. So I basically did a lot of testing and playing around with JAWS demos and things like that at home. And also, at the same time as I was working as a classroom assistant at the college, one of the students that I met there was involved with the local society for the blind, who I basically ended up getting quite involved with and doing some project work at a disability centre, where we were able to basically take control a bit more, because it's very different when you're in a large institution like a college. If you want anything changed, it tends to be the case that the left department doesn't know what the right department's doing. When you're a small independent group all by yourself, it's a different story, and you can make your own decisions. You know, the committee say let's have this, and that's what you have. So basically I started to, in parallel with my work for the college, work for a local community thing, organisation for the blind, where in addition to getting them a grant from the National Lottery Charities Board to get some computer equipment for their office, we made sure we bought JAWS, by the way, and a lot of accessibility good decent accessibility equipment, like scan and read stuff and whatever. And that basically meant that I was able, through the practice I was getting, you know, in a more independent environment, to basically build on my experience and to try things out. And I basically got to do a lot of work with it like that. But I made a point at home of playing around with HAL. What was the worst part about it, basically, were the inbuilt voices were absolutely awful. I'm sure you and Chris and anyone else who's British on here will know that the HAL screen reader has not got the most appealing standard voices in the world to listen to. In fact, it's very much like a robot or something, a very monotonous and awful reading voice. So I started playing around, and I found out that I could install the SAPI, Microsoft SAPI speech synthesizer, and get HAL to use that. So I was able to work on improved voices, although the navigation's still quite poor compared to JAWS, on HAL. At least we were able to get it working with a more, you know, a less painful range of voices. And that was obviously all done with the students and computer users that I knew in mind. And quite a few of them now are using, if they're still stuck using HAL or Supernova, which is the magnification and speech equivalent of HAL, are using it with improved voices as a result of the work that I did. So I thought that was quite worthwhile.
Oh yes, indeed, yeah, and more power to your elbow too. And as a result of this work that you've done with visually handicapped people, I know that some sort of award was awarded to you back in the summer. Could you tell us what that was and how it came about, and what actually happened when you received the award? So there's a nice little few questions for you to get your teeth into.
Right, okay, Steve, no problem there. Yeah, basically, my work with this community organisation, the name of which is VISOR, V-I-S-O-R. It's an abbreviation for the Visually Impaired Society of Richmond, and it's one of the local societies for the blind. And basically I worked voluntarily for them as a project coordinator. I was basically continually trying, and I did make probably something like 20 grant trust applications to try and get some funding. I was really determined that they were going to establish themselves in the community, and ended up helping them to become a registered charity. and basically to get grant funding as a result of my working part-time for the college. I applied to the Learning Skills Council for a grant which was basically to pay me as a paid tutor to work as a paid capacity working out in the community for VISA at the Disability Action Advice Centre in Teddington, teaching accessible technology training workshops to visually impaired students. So basically, over a period of 20 weeks during last year, 2001, I basically ran training workshops which were very small class sizes, two people at the most, and sometimes one. People would come down for, you know, and they literally had really good tutor attention. They could ask any questions they wanted, and we had a computer in the office which was connected via the local authority to the internet. So here and there, we actually said hello to some people and for the people from the workshops, which was great. And I made a point actually of thanking those people and for the people for they gave such a warm reception. You know, what I would typically do is wait until lunchtime to give some of our American friends time to get out of bed. And then once I had somebody there who was there to do their workshop, I'd say, well, would you like to check out this network? And I'd go on and say hi to whoever was in the coffee shop. Quite often people like Terry and Parker and Bob in Wichita would be there, you know, drinking their first cups of coffee. It was afternoon for us, and I would say, oh, good morning to you. Well, I've got John from Scotland here. Would you like to say hello and tell him a little bit about For the People, you know? And so as part of the workshops, I introduced some of them to FTT, and I'm very glad that they did. As I say, they thoroughly enjoyed it and got a good reception. Anyway, those workshops were a great success, and what they basically led to was that the provision of courses at the college have now changed. There is now a mainstream full-time course in internet at Richmond Adult College for visually impaired students, and guess who's the tutor on it? Me. Which was a good result, you know, because it's very difficult to get things to change in these large institutions, and it's funny how I had to go to an outside organisation, do something in the community, prove that that could work before, you know, the institution would listen and do something about it and, you know, upgrade their facilities and adjust their courses available to accommodate what was obviously a high need area, i.e. those people who were visually impaired and doing computing were very keen to get onto the internet. And, you know, that had to be done. So basically what happened was that around about January of this year, I received a notification from our local council for voluntary service, which was basically in recognition of the volunteer work that I did with VISA, and in recognition of the workshops that told us that the project that I'd run in 2001 had been nominated successfully for a Queen's Golden Jubilee Community Award. So I was rather chuffed about that, yes. And when you say about what actually happened concerning the award was that Jay, my partner, and I went to a reception which was held by the Council for Voluntary Service, where the Mayor of Richmond was there. We didn't meet the Queen, even though it was a Queen's Golden Jubilee Community Award, but we did get to see the Mayor of Richmond, and, you know, a formal trophy was basically presented to VISA for the project. So it was quite a nice thing to get something like that recognised, and it had been very hard work to do. I hadn't realised quite what I was taking on when I'd originally written the plans to take it on, so it was nice in a way, you know, even though it was several months after it had finished, to get recognition for it, and that was the form in which it came.
Yeah, many congratulations as well to you on all your hard work. I'm sure that you know, you've enriched the lives of people in that part of London tremendously. So now then that you're the tutor for this course, what does it actually involve? What do you take people through? And I think I know the answer to this one, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What sort of reaction do you get from your students when they first sit in front of a PC with a screen reader?
Well, you do get some quite surprising reactions sometimes. If people aren't familiar with it, Steve, you know, just to hear a synthesized voice kind of freaks people out, I think would be the right answer there. Also, well, I'm working in a group setting here. I'm teaching in the main open learning room at the college on Monday mornings, and we basically do all email basics, and it is an accredited course, but it's accredited under the Open College Network. Roughly six students, and basically all working simultaneously together, and one thing I do is use speech boxes. so that, because I'm very aware of the fact that if everybody's wearing headphones and you're trying to train and you know, while you're trying to talk to them, the screen reader's going, all that kind of stuff. So I'm very outward about the sound, and I do think that in a group training setting it's a good idea to have the speech actually filling the room so that everybody can hear it. So after I'd sorted out how and improved the voices by getting it working on the Sappy screen speech synthesizer, I then basically you know, went ahead to do group training with speech working out loud, so that even those students who had useful sight that may be using speech and assisted capacity could hear what was going on with the speech synthesizer. But yeah, it got them the most shock reactions came from the mainstream students that were all around us, not from the visually impaired ones who were kind of, you know, they'd anticipated it, or by the time they're on the internet course they'd already done word processing using HAL anyway. So, you know, they were familiar with it at a basic level, but they got to hear, thanks to this course, what it's like trying to use speech when you're trying to browse the net and do email and things like that.
Yeah, so basically you're teaching what, word processing skills and a little bit of internet and things like that. Is that the sort of thing you're instructing?
Yes, but you missed out on an important subject from there. When I ran the accessible technology workshops, the ones that got the award last year, desktop publishing and internet skills were the two subjects there. So because I'm very keenly into desktop publishing and printing and doing electric image design and all that kind of stuff, and it has occurred to me since that a lot of this work to do with image and producing printed publications basically hasn't been done or doesn't seem to have been provided even at some of the mainstream blind schools. You know, I met some representatives from RNC and places like that, and desktop publishing just doesn't seem to be a subject for some reason. And it's a really interesting subject. You know, you go into print technique and things like that, and you know, working with different image formats, using a scanner for scanning photographs in. And I had some visually impaired students who were already keenly into photography who were able to bring the photographs in, scan them and lay them out in documents. And as a result, going back to, in fact, before the workshops had started, we started to produce a large print newsletter, a copy of which I've got here on my right-hand side, and I basically oversaw and became the editor of the newsletter, which we basically ran quarterly. It's an 8-page, every copy is in colour, everything's in large print, and it involves the laying out of photographs, headings, titles, using different colours, things like that. We tried to work, or I tried my best to work, to the RNIB See It Right guidelines on producing accessible large print for those with sight disabilities that you know, need large print format. So basically integrated desktop publishing into producing a community newsletter, which was really good stuff.
Yeah, I'm glad you've told me about that, Leon, and probably people listening, because personally speaking, I've heard this term desktop publishing bandied around. I've never really known what it means. I've never really understood what it is. So basically that's it, is it? It's how to lay out printed material in a graphically pleasing way, and to insert pictures and stuff. Is that right? Because I'm very, very vague on this.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, yeah. The proofreading that takes place in desktop publishing would involve checking the copy. You know, you must have heard of people working as proofreaders before, and that's a little bit more than just a spell check. That's spelling and grammar checking carefully, and also checking the context of the thing, making sure it reads in a good way. So you'd be, you know, basically responsible as a proofreader for checking that the copy reads okay, but also you proofread the design, and you look at the design, and it brings in that design element where basically, you know, you can say, well, okay, how about this typeface? You know, this looks okay, and someone else might say, yeah, it's okay, but, you know, it's not as clear as it could be, and you basically work together as a team when you're doing something like a community newsletter anyway, and get as much feedback from people as possible. So it involves quite a lot of the open-ended design process, which is difficult because you can spend hours deciding, you know, should we have it this way, should we have it that, and whatever. So it's particularly the design process side in desktop publishing is difficult because you're normally working to deadlines. We always were. We had an A3 printer and we had to get 200 copies out by the sort of by yesterday, as it were, all the time. So basically, you're often working under time pressure, and that was one nice thing about doing the desktop publishing, working on a real running publication. education was that you know, you had to basically allow for people's design and design input and everything, and still stick to time schedules where you could, you know, keeping like a watch on the clock. If you didn't keep an eye on the time, then you know, you just basically wouldn't ever complete the task. So it was a balance between that. But yeah, basically that's what desktop publishing is. It involves a lot of graphics work, design work, layout work, also checking the copy and overseeing a whole publication, then looking into the print techniques, different print media, what you can print into, and you know, lastly, issues such as copyright and getting ISBN numbers, how to copyright a publication, that kind of stuff.
Well, thanks for that little lesson. That's been, you know, from my point of view alone, it's been very constructive. I'd no idea. Now, I know as well, Leon, that you are a qualified computer engineer, and I just wondered if, with the skill you have, whether you actually pay home visits to VI people to put right their systems when they've gone wrong, which they inevitably do. We all know computers and their little foibles. Do you actually go on site and sort people's problems out, or is it just in the college that you work?
No, I do go on site as well, Steve. In actual fact, when I first started working as a voluntary classroom assistant, I was known as the cycling computer repair person because I would ride as far afield as Putney from where I live, or Barnes and those sorts of areas, to go out to help blind people with their computer problems at home, and I would do it all for free. I would cycle all the way over there, and you know, I'd save somebody's computer from burning out because the cooler fan on the processor had gone, and then pedalled off down the shop and got a new fan and come and put it back, because I'm a hardware engineer. You're quite right, I'm a qualified engineer, but that is in computer hardware, and basically I've had a lot of experience of fixing up computers and trying my best to get some older computer systems so that they are usable and accessible for people who are visually impaired, who are not necessarily who cannot necessarily afford a new machine. As you know, they're very expensive. So I've done quite a bit of computer recycling and quite a bit of home technical support as well, and there are quite a few people around now. If something goes wrong with the system, they'll give me a call, and I'll do my best to go and service it for them. I don't work for free anymore, unfortunately. I've found that I've just been too busy to be able to do that. But what I always do is have a special VIP rate. So if someone's a visually impaired person, then I'll charge them as little as I can possibly get away with, you know, just say travel expenses to get there or something like that, if I can. And if it's a friend, I might still do it for free, you know. But I can't do quite as much as I used to, but I do still local home technical support for people, yes.
Okay. Now, I know people like yourself and myself and most of the people listening to us, we sort of like live, eat, breathe computers, but there must be other interests which you actually have. What do you do in your spare time, if you have any spare time, with all these activities?
Well, spare time is a real issue for me, basically. One of the situations is where I work for the college. I'm a part-time tutor, so when it comes to the summer break between when the college year ends in around about May and when it goes back in September, each year, and I'm now in my third year of working for the college, I'm out of work, and it's unpaid leave. Yes, it's nice holidays, but it's unpaid. So I end up with a large time gap to fill every summer. It's worked out that way, so that this is the third time running when I've had to get around and do freelance work and do odd jobs and do just about anything I can to keep paying the bills that inevitably come in through the letterbox on a regular basis. So I keep myself busy, but in addition, typically I'm one of these people who my time has to be scheduled. I can't operate without having a schedule, so that basically I know what I'm up to on a Monday, I know what I'm up to on a Tuesday, on a Wednesday I'll be there, on a Thursday I'll be somewhere else and whatever, and I try to fit those things in that one can easily do on a regular basis. Now, some time ago, as you know, I'm sure what you're referring to there, Steve, is my saxophone playing. And for coming up to 5 years, basically, I've been playing alto saxophone. I started off going to an evening class, just like anybody would, beginner's class. My mum gave me an alto saxophone to try and encourage me to get into music, and she knows I appreciate jazz and different music and everything. So for 5 years now, just about every Tuesday night, I've been going out to rehearsals with a jazz big band, and I'm second alto player with a band which is called the Madison Dance Orchestra. And in actual fact, I really do enjoy playing the saxophone. It's great therapy, it's great for stress relief. I love music anyway, and so that is probably my number one hobby, is music, undoubtedly. Listening to music, appreciating music, and playing alto saxophone with a jazz big band certainly brightens up my whole week, and it's a lot more fun than any computer stuff will ever be, I can assure you.
Yeah, I've heard you play the sax on the Peeps, actually, and very good you are too. You played Happy Birthday. I remember on one occasion, it was really good. It was for me as well. It made my birthday back in December. So thanks for that. I've heard you play. You're very good. And I know you're interested in music, because we see you've been played again, Sam, playing obscure jazz records from all eras. Is that your favourite type of music, like the obscure rather than the run-of-the-mill?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, if there's any type of music I don't tend to like, it's pop. You know, the stuff which is in the charts these days just does not appeal. There's no musical content. They can't even seem to write a decent song. You know, they're lyricless, melodyless, and all this stuff. But what I really am interested in is all of the music that is well before my time. Hence one reason probably why I've taken to the Play It Again Sam scenario like a duck to water. Because to me, there's nothing better than to be on online talking to friends from around the world, and not only that, they've been able to basically inspire me, and you know, I'd like to thank everyone basically for that, because some of the stuff that's being played, you know, we, as you know, Steve, there's not much country music going on over here. We get to hear country music through For the People that we wouldn't hear just about anywhere else. We get to hear some great jazz, and as you know, there's been the wonderful thing with the cabaret going on recently, and the whole music scene on here is marvellous. There's a great many gifted musicians, and there's a great many lovely people who also enjoy participating in Play It Again Sam, and I really do enjoy that. I love to learn about music which is before my time, and I don't set any early limit on that. You know, I don't say, oh, I'm not going to like that, that's from 1920 something or whatever. I like to have an open ear to everything, and I really do enjoy, most of all, I think, music from the past, as it were, you know, to the great 20th century music, and I think it will take a lifetime to explore it all. I wish I could, I really enjoy the voyage of discovery and hearing some of the older music that's been recorded, and the great playing and the great songs that were written and everything. So yeah, I've got a real big thing for nostalgia in music, definitely.
Yeah, I knew you had, and I've enjoyed listening to some of the rarities that you've played, and really enjoyed them. And it's a pretty obvious thing to say, but you can't have a conversation with Leon without hearing some fantastic noises in the background. And I think we all know that Leon's got a minor bird there with him. Just as we're winding up now, Leon, at the end of the interview, just tell us how long you've had your minor bird. And he makes some fantastic noises, doesn't he? And I'm sure I've heard him imitating your saxophone on more than one occasion. He's got a great repertoire.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. He certainly has. And he's quite a well-known bird, actually, I suppose, on here now. Because, you know, I can't avoid people hearing him in the background. He's so vocal. Yeah, he's a greater hill minor bird, which is a large variety, because there is a lesser hill and there are other varieties of minor bird. And he's quite large. Larger than a starling. He's about the size of a crow or magpie, basically, in size. And yes, he has got a great repertoire. They're well known for their imitation and mimicking the sounds in the environment, and he copies the telephone sound to perfect pitch. He copies dogs barking. He even makes a rumbling sound that's a copy of the trains going past. He copies screaming rockets from last bonfire night. He's basically any sound that he can hear from the environment, he's prone to picking up and repeating back. And yes, he's a great and interesting pet. He's very friendly, he's hand tamed, he's 7 years old. They live around about the age of 16, and as I've been reading up and finding out, they actually get better and better at talking as they get older. So should be interesting in the future to see how he goes, just going by the different sounds that he makes now. But yeah, he's a great pet. It's low maintenance compared to, you know, I live in a small flat, Steve, so it's basically just a matter of clearing his cage out, changing his water and giving him his food. So he's quite easy to keep and he's quite happy. He's got a large cage and it's right by a window where he can talk to the birds outside and communicate with those. And furthermore, when I first started to come on for the people, I've met one or two other people on here who've also got pet birds, and as a result, my minor bird has met several parrots, some cockatiels and some other birds over for the people, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the same speaking to you without all that fantastic sounds in the background, Leon. Okay, well, we're coming towards the end of the interview now, so what have you been doing in recent months? Just bring us right up to date on your activities in the last, say, couple of months or so.
Right, okay, Steve. Yeah, I basically got this situation where, you know, I'm between work as a result of college having ended until I go back working as a tutor on the 16th of September. And what I've needed to do there is to basically find some way of having some money coming in. I was very fortunate in that I got a call from one of the college departments, which is called the Business Training Services Department, and they basically offer outreach training from college tutors to different organisations in the community, and I was offered an 8-week contract, which I'm basically into week 5 of at the moment. I've got 3 more weeks to go, where I have been teaching desktop publishing over at a youth project in Hampton, which is quite interesting. It's making good use of my skills. It's a good challenge to me. There's a computer network with all Windows 2000 machines there, and that's at a youth project, so it's my first experience of being involved with youth organisation. So that's been keeping me busy one day a week during the summer. And in addition to that, I've got a friend who runs his own innovative technology company, and I did a bit of freelance work for them setting up a wireless network, my first experience of setting up using a wireless access point, wireless network cards, a computer network that works basically with about 3 PCs, 1 laptop and 1 Macintosh, all sharing a single DSL connection with no wires between any of the machines. So that was an interesting challenge. It's presented a lot of technical difficulties that thankfully I've had the patience to get over for that. So I've been doing that, on a part-time basis. And also, somewhere else, I've been working for somebody else who basically has got a computer shop which supplies hardware, and he decided he's going to divide his shop into two and run a cyber cafe. So I've helped to set up an internet cafe just a few miles from home. So I've been doing some freelance work again over there, helped to set up an internet cyber cafe, which is working really well, using Windows 2000 server and Windows ME on all the workstations, and that's now up and running. So I've basically tried to make the most of my computer skills and try and earn some decent income from it, although I could be earning more. I've done it for the learning's sake as well, if you know what I mean, and so I've got quite a bit of experience under my belt now. But yeah, I would like to have had a summer off. Sadly, I would have been completely skint if I'd done that, so I have kept myself busy.
And very, very busy you are too, obviously. Cool. I don't know how you pack it all in. It must be incredibly, you must have an incredibly tight schedule to fit all this this stuff in. Okay, well, finally, can I just ask you about For the People? How did you discover For the People? And really, I'd like to know, as a sighted person, as I say, you're one of very, very few sighted people on the site, what sort of experience have you had as a sighted For the People member?
Oh, Steve, it's been absolutely fantastic. I guess how things really started was that with I've got a friend, who Mark Fireball, who's on here, who's visually impaired. And we've gotten to the point where we were logging in on our computers and talking over MSN Messenger together, and basically we were just exploring all the different avenues, including accessible chat and different ways that there could be that we could communicate together over the PC. You know, we're particularly looking into, you know, voice-enabled applications, and between us we came across For the People around about last July. We both signed up and we both joined it to give it a good go, and it's been marvellous ever since. What I was completely taken aback by, Steve, was the quality of person on this network. The people were so helpful to each other and so welcoming, and it's just it to this day it still touches me, and it's so great. I've made so many online friends over the time that I've been here on the network. That was before the September 11th of last year, and I'm sure you would agree with me that being on this network while those sorts of major things were going on was quite some experience, and it was great. What's great to see on here is how people really rallied around and pulled together during really difficult times, and there's been so much helping of others, basically, so I was very, very impressed, and I still am very much impressed with the For the People network. I think that although it is a network which is primarily consists of visually impaired and blind people that's on here, it's leading the mainstream and sighted world in terms of a quality worldwide network where people get together as a community and set a good example of being supportive and being a community and being friends to one another. I don't think there's anything on the whole mainstream internet that compares to the For the People network. It is that good to me, and it means so much, as do all my great online friends I've got to meet over the time I've been on here.
Leon, I think that's a marvellous note on which to end. Can I thank you on behalf of everyone in the room for agreeing to do this interview? It's been most entertaining, and I've learnt a great deal from you. So that's the end of the official interview. I just wonder if you'd be prepared to take any questions from the floor, so to speak. But thanks, Leon. That was really, really good.
Well, thank you, Steve. You've done an absolutely great job. And thanks to everyone for sticking around to listen as well. I feel quite relieved now, Steve. I'm a little bit parched just at the moment, so I could just nip and grab a cold drink and come back, and then I'll be quite happy to answer anybody's questions.
Yeah, could I ask you, Leon, the cyber cafe that you set up for your friend, was there any sort of access tech you thought of adding in his cyber cafe?
No, there wasn't, Chris. No, it's just a mainstream one, literally, totally commercial. It's in a busy high street, and he got an A3 printer in over there, so I've done some posters to go up on the windows and that kind of stuff, and it's pulling in passers-by. And the area that it's in, Feltham, there's very few people around there with disabilities. It's one of these areas where they tend to stay away because it's an area which has got a bad reputation. So we haven't had the call for that so far. But, one of the other things is, there is general disabilities. Not all issues on accessibility necessarily just relate to visually impaired people, as I'm sure most of you know. Not everybody who's visually impaired, their visual impairment is their only disability. I certainly found that out, and that was the hardest part of the Visor project I was working on, coming to terms with a student who had epilepsy, and two students who were wheelchair users as well as visually impaired, and things like that, I think that, a lot of the stuff to do with accessibility, that it applies generally to people with disabilities. A computer can be inaccessible from being out of reach and things like that, through not having a cordless keyboard or something that somebody could use comfortably and things like that. So, the whole thing with the accessibility, it's being pushed for more and more. The CyberCaf project was basically good in the way that, I'm trying to brush up on and work on my computer networking skills and whatever. But if necessary, if the request came in there, I'm sure that we would go to the lengths to make it accessible. It's kind of optional at the moment for public organisations. However, for the college, it's a different story, because there's a new bill which has come out, Chris. I don't know if you've heard of it, the Sender Bill, and that is the Special Educational Needs Discrimination Act. And it means that colleges have got a legal requirement, so they're kind of dreading, when the next draft of students turn up in September, some blind student could come along and say, right, I want to do, literacy, or I want to do law or something, and by law the college has to make it accessible, or they'll be subject to prosecution, so educational organisations really have got the law to face now. That the Sender Bill is going to make a big difference to them, but private organisations, unfortunately, are still pretty much on a free rein.
Yeah, I just find that when I have people down to, have a look at my PC from time to time and what have you, and I've got a techie man down helping me. How amazed they are and never seen stuff like this before. It's just a shame that it's not stuck out in people's faces more than it actually is, that I suppose places like general public, where the general public would visit, would actually get them to know that what is available, not only for the sake of what's available to them, but what's available for blind people or disabled people to access a computer. And it's just, people maybe would help more towards funding for those types of things if it was more in their faces sort of thing, yeah?
Oh yeah, I quite agree with you, and I had a very strange thing happen actually, because it was after I started volunteering for the local visually impaired society, that I went back and applied to the college for paid work. You know, I'd only been volunteering there before, just to get my teacher training done, and I thought, right, I'll go, they've got paid jobs for part-time tutors, I'll see if I can get on board, you know, could be good money and good challenging work and all this stuff. And so I went back to apply to the college for a paid work job. And the guy who was the head of supported learning there said to me, so I understand you've done this Visa project and you've got a really accessible computer. Which computer package did you find was the most accessible one there? And he asked me this in this casual way. So I replied Supernova straight away, because Dolphin Supernova is a combination screen enlarger and screen reader. And it works really well when you've basically got a whole diverse range of people with different visual impairments to deal with. You've got different enlarger settings for different people, you know, different colour schemes loaded up on the same computer, different speech settings for different people and all this. So I replied to this guy, El Supernova was definitely the best, it was the most flexible package. They promptly went out and bought a site license for the college for Supernova. I didn't know he was going to take me at my word. So all the computers in the Open Learning Centre have got Supernova on. As a result of that, because all the students are being trained with Supernova, last year, London Borough of Richmond branch of libraries decided that they were going to set up this People's Network, this thing called the People's Network, which basically there's free internet access in every branch library right across the whole London Borough of Richmond. And they decided they were going to have one accessible machine in every branch library, and which program they decided to put on for the accessible machine? Supernova again. So in a strange knock-on way, I've been responsible for all the branch libraries having that particular software package on there, and I feel quite guilty about it, because it's not the best, definitely, for screen reader, people who are screen reader dependent, but there you go. And that's very much in public profile, you know, having an accessible machine in every branch library.
I say, Lynn, have you got any influence in getting these authorities, not so much to have AL and to have something like JAWS or something like that? Because it looks to me that most of the authorities are having AL, because it's a cheaper way of doing screen reading. And I wonder if you've got any sort of influence in that direction.
Well, I guess I have got a little bit there, Jeff, and I've tried to use it. I really have tried to use it, you know. I've actually prompted the college about window eyes. I think they ought to go in the window eyes direction, and I'd like them to do that, so I'm trying to encourage them to do that. Also, I mean, I didn't get to mention everything, but I teach music therapy on Monday evenings to adults with learning difficulties, which is a very challenging coursework as well. I put in a requisition form to try and get a Soundbeam 2, which is basically a wireless MIDI trigger device that enables people with profound and multiple disabilities to play MIDI instruments just in the air and whatever. And, you know, for the sensory impairment department to get a hold of window eyes and get a sight license for it. But the way it's looking at the moment is that I know they've just updated, all the computers have been updated to Windows XP. And what they've done, because it was cheaper, is just done an upgrade license to Supernova 5, the newest version. But if ever I can, I certainly, you know, keeping in mind the needs of screen reader dependent people, there are a lot better packages than HAL around, and if I can swing it in that direction, I certainly will do. You know, I'll do my bit basically, Jeff, but I am still a little guy in a huge organisation, if you know what I mean. So I'll take it as far as I can.
Oh, that's great, Leon. It's nice to know there's somebody like you out there that are helping them to get some of the right screen readers in. And before I finish, I'd like to thank Steve. He always does a very professional job. I've told him before, I imagine he's starting to blush a little bit now, but he's extremely good at these interviews. I was under his interviewing a fortnight ago, and he did an extremely good job for me as well. Once again, Steve, thanks very much.
Yeah, I was really sorry that I missed your spotlight, Jeff, but as somebody recently said on here, apparently they're going to be archiving them soon, or some of the past ones will be available, so I'd love to hear your interview too there, and glad to hear that that went so well as well, and I think you're quite right, Steve does do a great job.
Well, Spotlight will be back in 2 weeks, and I think our friend Jennifer will be interviewing someone on the 7th of September, and so we'll be looking forward to that. But thanks again, Leon. You did a really great job, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, thank you, Becky, and careful, you're dazzling me there, you know, pointing that bright spotlight in my direction.
You deserve it and much, much more.